Do you ever struggle with remembering details from your travels? Then I've got something special for you. How would you like a better way to keep track of all the things you see and experience in Scotland? A way to keep those special memories and all the details fresh for years to come? My new Scotland Travel Journal might just be what you need. It includes daily journaling prompts to help you start writing about your day, lots of space for doodling and notes, prompts to reflect on your trip overall, and suggestions for things to do that help you make more meaningful connections with Scotland. There's also inspiration for your travel bucket list, a map to draw your route, space to keep track of your travel details, and some Gaelic and Scottish phrases to try while you're here. All you have to do is print out the journal, fold the pages in half, and start writing. The Scotland Travel Journal is the perfect companion for your upcoming trip to Scotland. Find it in the Watch Me See online shop or visit the link in the show notes. And now, let's get on with the show. This episode is sponsored by Harp Archaeology, a social enterprise that aims to promote and enhance public understanding and awareness of archaeology and cultural heritage. Find out more at harparchaeology.co.uk. Hello there, and welcome to Wild for Scotland, a podcast full of immersive travel stories from Scotland. I'm your host and storyteller, Cathy Kamleitner. Wild for Scotland helps you connect with Scotland, its people, wildlife, landscapes and histories. In every episode, I either whisk you away on a beautiful adventure or introduce you to inspiring locals and their stories. In between, I share my top tips for your own Scotland trip and how to follow in my footsteps. So lean back and enjoy. Let's travel to Scotland. Today, I have an episode for you that has been a long time coming. I met Michelle Gamble a few years ago when I joined the team at Wonder Seekers for an educational trip to Oban and Fort William. Avid listeners might remember our story Never the Same and my conversation with Katie Murray about scientific tourism from season 3. Michelle was one of the other participants on that group. And together with Ian Hill, she works for a social enterprise called Harp Archaeology. They run field schools at archaeological sites around the UK and work with community groups to expand their awareness and understanding of their local archaeology. Some of their work is aimed at archaeology students looking for hands-on experience, but they also offer programmes for people with a personal interest in archaeology. I remember back then, Michelle told me about their plans to develop a tour about Scottish history and archaeology that would be led by archaeologists. And now, those plans have finally come to fruition. Michelle and Ian invited me along to join their very first archaeology tour to the Scottish borders. Although the word tour doesn't quite do the time we spent together justice. What they offer is an experience where you get to engage with professional archaeologists and ask all your burning questions about the past. On our trip, we got to handle historic artefacts, meet experts to tell us more about different aspects of Scottish history, and try our hand at archaeological methods and skills, like reading buildings, drawing gravestones, and field walking. If you've ever wanted to learn more about Scottish history, and more importantly, get up close with it, I can't recommend enough joining one of their forthcoming tours. It's hard to fit all the experiences I've had over those 3 days into a single podcast episode, but I'm going to give it a try anyways. This is Like an Open Book. I'm standing on the slope of an exposed hillside. Strong gusts of wind are rushing through my hair, which is held in place by a warm knitted headband, trying to defy the elements. The ground is rough underfoot as I follow a bumpy path across the short grass. Every now and then, rocks poke through the top layer of soil, sometimes just a single pebble, but I suspect others are huge boulders, revealing only their tips above the ground, like icebergs. Above me, about 30 metres in the distance, stands the impressive ruin of Hume Castle. Only that it isn't the actual Hume Castle that was built here in the 12th century. No, that castle was destroyed by the 1600s. The castle I see today was built much later, in the 18th century, by a wealthy man who lived in a comfortable mansion a few miles away. He wanted a castle on his land that he could see from his window, and so this version of Hume Castle was built. It features tall and oversized castellated walls that seem to serve no other purpose than to be seen from the distance. It's like the architects looked at a child's drawing of a castle and built it just like that. Unlike most people who stop by Hume Castle, though, we're not really interested in the main structure on the top of the hill. We keep our eyes firmly on the ground, looking for lumps and bumps that might tell another story about this place. We, that's a small tour group of eager guests, and our two guides, Ian and Michelle from Harp Archaeology. They are professional archaeologists and have taken us on a tour to the Scottish borders to learn about the history of the Romans, walk in the footsteps of armies during the Rough Wooing, and have a go at being archaeologists ourselves. Hume Castle is our first stop. Under Ian and Michelle's guidance, we're exploring the barely visible remains of the old road leading to the castle and trace the outline of what might have been its gatehouse. Only, when you know what you're looking for, the remains aren't actually as hard to see as you might think. When a line on the ground looks too straight to be natural, there's a great chance that it isn't. One of the first things I learned quickly on this trip is that archaeology is so much more than digging up the ground in search for precious artifacts. It's also more than an action-packed adventure abroad, no matter how many times you watch Indiana Jones. Archaeology is, at its core, the study of humans that seeks to understand our past through the traces we leave behind in the landscape. To an archaeologist, the landscape is in many ways like an open book, waiting to be read. These traces may be grand structures like castles or walls, but they might also have been reduced to the ground, buried beneath layers of rubble and soil. Both can tell us much about the people who've left them behind, and both are equally fascinating.
I think it makes it a little bit clearer as to what we're talking about when we say a rectangular structure. You might like literally stand right where I was.
As we walk from Hume Castle to a nearby kirkyard, Michelle points out more traces in the landscape. The parallel lines in the fields are rig and furrow, a historic farming technique of ploughed ridges on the ground. The path we're walking on was once a road, but the stones have since long been repurposed to build the walls that line the path on both sides today. Just beyond, we see a crescent-shaped group of boulders, a quarry where these stones were taken hundreds of years ago. If you don't pay attention, these traces in the landscape might escape you. And that's what this experience is all about. While the rest of the group explores the gravestones in the kirkyard, I ask Michelle and Ian how their tours came about and what they're hoping people take away from them.
Yeah. So we started, I think it's been around for a while for us to, we just love sharing archaeology and history with as many people as we can. But we started out with a project that we were doing in the Highlands in Perthshire. And we were bringing people along to explore General Wade's roads. And we had a lot of people coming from outside of an archaeological background. And there was a lot of interest in what we were doing. And they came from everything from CEOs of pharmaceutical companies to, you know, people working in shops who wanted to have a go. And it sort of made us realize that there's a real desire out there for people to see the world through sort of a different lens. And the lens we're hoping to provide for people by coming to the borders and sort of exploring with us is that they would get the chance to sort of see the landscape and see monuments and see different things than they would normally see, but through the eyes of an archaeologist. So having the chance to have a go at doing something a bit different and getting the chance to see, yeah, the borders actually, which is sort of a bit undiscovered right now.
Yeah, and I think in terms of why we're doing it, where we're doing it, the borders has got so much to offer from a historical viewpoint, archaeological viewpoint, natural heritage as well. There's so much that goes on here, but one of the brilliant things is the evidence is still visible. A lot of the landscape is, whilst there's a lot of farming and agriculture, there's large areas of land that are underdeveloped. It's one of the largest regions in the country, but a really, really sparsely populated area. So it's not had as much impact from development. And so as well as having a huge amount of sites ranging from prehistory, you know, there's literally hundreds of prehistoric hill forts in the region. And then the number of castles and peel towers or defended settlements from the medieval period because of the wars with England, there's the evidence is pretty much everywhere you look, you'll see something from a period of history or prehistory.
Yeah.
So it's a really, really, really rich place.
That is so fascinating. And of course, over the 3 days we're spending together, we'll dive into so many different of those time periods, which I think is so cool. But something you said, Michelle, there kind of resonated so much with me because we only spent a few hours so far on this trip together and we visited Hume Castle and now we're in the nearby Kirkyard. And already in both of those places, I think if you just visit on a regular basis, you would be in and out within maybe half an hour, just walking about a little bit, looking at some of the stones or the remains of the castle. But you wouldn't actually spend as much time as we did really looking at the evidence of different structures that are, you know, maybe only on ground level and things like that. So already I feel like we've dug so much deeper, to use that phrase, than you would on a regular basis.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that it gives you a chance to sort of definitely see the thing in front of you from a very different perspective. And so one of the things that's important to us is to realize that what we're seeing is only one layer of the history of an area or a site or a location. And what's under it or what's even just visible but not necessarily noticeable, shall we say, is right there to be explored. But it just takes someone who has a little bit of experience in that area to sort of open your eyes to it. And then you can hopefully, the hope for us is that the takeaway for people from this tour will be that when they go on their walks or they look around their own landscapes, that they can see things a bit differently and maybe see things from a conservation point of view, where things that we want to preserve and how important natural heritage is and how important some of our historic heritages as well, like some of the buildings and the landscapes that we need to sort of preserve as well and just see them a bit differently.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we're labeling it as a tour, but I think we're probably offering more than what someone might view as a tour. It's more, you know, we want to provide that experience, as Michelle says, for people to take something more away. And as you said, Kathy, you know, you might go in and have a look around and see the stuff, or you might have somebody that can tell you the history whilst you're there, but you're only in there for half an hour or so. But yeah, it's a different way to look at it. It's a more interactive experience with the site that you're visiting, I think, which is really, which is what we really, really hope that people can get a positive experience of, really.
We don't expect everyone to go around with monument recording forms in their back pockets, taking a look at every stone and whatever else and sort of recording them in the great detail that you've had the chance now to record a monument. So,
yeah, so it really is what you just said. It's not just a tour. It's a learning experience with a lot of expertise on the ground, which is really, really amazing. I guess with all of that then behind me in a few days' time, if we look into the future, how will that then impact how I experience Scotland or historic sites in other places in the future?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. And what we hope it gives you is like a greater appreciation of what you're seeing. So perhaps being able to unpick some of those layers, which gives you a greater depth of understanding and taking away from it that you can't just accept on face value what you see. If you accept Hume on face value as a castle, you're in for a big surprise because, as you've learned, it's not just a castle. So I think that going away from here, we hope that you'll be able to sort of apply some of the things that you learn, and hopefully you're having a good time doing it with us and seeing some different things, but apply them then to other sites where you can say, oh yeah, right, that lump and bump over there isn't just a lump and a bump. It actually looks like, oh, it's kind of linear. Maybe it's a house. Maybe it's this. How can I think about this site differently? And then perhaps it inspires you to read about it or, find out more. And even if it doesn't, you've sort of created in your head, perhaps your own imagination can tell a story. And that in itself, going to other sites in Scotland, I mean, Scotland's full of imagination. And I think you really need it to explore and to be able to see everything that's here. So
one other thing that I hope that people are able to take away from this, I mean, there's a chance that the people who will be interested to take part in these things already spend a lot of time outdoors. But if not, it's the health benefits, both physical and mental, of getting out and about and spending time outside is incredible. And I think cultural heritage can play a huge part in that. And it could be that you may be somebody that does the same walk over and over and over and over again, but the next time you go on it, you'll be looking at it in a very different way. And yeah, it could inspire you. It might be that you thought about going for a walk somewhere, but then you thought against it. But if you know that there could be something else, or you might be looking at things a little bit differently, it's yeah, hopefully it'll inspire people to get out more and appreciate the heritage. You know, this is, we love it. We're in the industry. We're passionate about it, but it only matters if more people are passionate about it and understand and care for it. And you know, so if we can sort of spread that passion and care and knowledge about all these things and make more people interested, then I mean that's our MO, really. So yeah,
that's like what we do.
Whether you're an archaeologist yourself or simply interested in archaeology, there are few places as fascinating as the Scottish borders. The region has the greatest density of hill forts in Europe, and thanks to its geographic location, it has seen countless of battles between the Scottish and the English forces, changing hands like a baton at a relay. It's also home to one of the most northerly settlements in the Roman Empire, and not to mention the dramatic border abbeys that brought power and wealth to the region during the Middle Ages. Wherever you turn, you'll uncover another layer of history, and no matter which period you're interested in, you'll find signs of it somewhere in the borders. And while Ian and Michelle know a lot about the area and have even led local excavations, they've made it a point to invite experts to join their tour for a while and tell their guests more. One of them is Rob Longworth, an ancient weapons expert and heritage and landscape officer at the Trimontium Museum in Melrose. We tour the exhibition to learn about the Roman fort that was first excavated here in the early 20th century. Many of the artefacts on display were found in one of 117 pits left behind by the Romans. Up to 4,000 people lived in this settlement, and it was used for hundreds of years. Sitting around the large table in the museum's learning centre, Rob hands round several objects. Some are replicas of pieces they found here and elsewhere in similar Roman forts. decorative hairpins, an ivory doll, and a toilet brush. Others are originals. A clay tile with footprints of a kitten. Glass beads used to decorate horses. Bangles and brooches, pottery and coins. It's incredible to hold them in my hand, just as the people who owned them did 2,000 years ago. After handling these objects, we follow Rob towards the site of the fort. As luck would have it, a group of volunteers is out there today, using metal detectors to scan the ground.
Hi guys.
Hello.
Hi guys, we're good. This is a group from Harp Archaeology who have been at the museum this morning. So we're just having a wander around to see what you guys are up to.
Yeah.
How's the day been?
Oh, we've got a couple of good planes.
Yeah, what you got?
Here in Trimontium, professional archaeologists and hobby detectorists work hand in hand to uncover more about the history of the fort. Without their volunteer effort, much less would be known. The landowner has even given them permission to search the fields and has adjusted how they're farmed to support this research. We can barely walk without stumbling upon smooth red rocks that look suspiciously like those red clay tiles we handled a few moments ago. We walk over to another group of detectorists, just as they pull out another treasure.
Ooh, wow.
A small silver coin.
It looks like it's just from yesterday.
Oh, amazing.
A shiny Roman denarius, barely bigger than the nail of my thumb.
Yeah, you kind of see the head on it there.
There's a portrait of an emperor on one side, although it's hard to tell exactly which one it is.
This shows you.
It looks extraordinary.
Always check.
Hard to believe it's 2,000 years old.
Once it's cleaned up, it'll be good.
But that's archaeology for you. Even as a layperson, I know that this is a special find. And it took years of research and training to get here. Later that day, we meet another expert. Jeff Parkhouse is a passionate local historian and takes us on a walk along Deer Street, a Roman road which ran from York past Melrose to the Antonine Wall. Chronologically, though, we've moved on from the Romans and into the 16th century, the time of the rough wooing. Jeff explains more.
Big hitters, you know, big headline figures. You've got Henry VIII in England. Everybody knows about him and his six wives. He was coming towards the end of his reign. He was even more grouchy than normal. And Mary, Queen of Scots, was just an infant, just 8 years old. No, less than that, sorry. She was looked after with advisors and so forth, who were basically running the realm for it with the aid of her mother, Mary. It's just at this time as well that Henry VIII, of course, had gone to from Catholic Church to the Protestant Church for the sake of his marriage. So basically what had happened is that the cleft between the Protestant Catholic Church in England and also in Scotland. And what meant that was that there were factions all over the place, and some were going towards, were actually being paid by Henry and bribed to try and go into Henry's camp, if you like, and the others were trying to keep Scotland away from Henry. So what we have is that Mary, as a young child, and Henry sees a really great chance. What you're doing is, Henry wanted to do, was to get Mary betrothed to his son, Edward, who is quite a bit older, but still a youngster. And if he could get Mary in Henry's court, then he has control. And he has control of Mary, the queen. His advisors are sidelined, and basically Scotland falls into his grasp. And that does away with the problem of every time Henry has a go at France, Scotland is at their back door. So there's this balance, right, between the two. And the old alliance kicks in every time that
either France or Scotland are attacked by England. It's one way of trying to keep England in place. So Henry first asks Scotland if Mary would become betrothed to Edward. They refuse. They realise what's going on. They realise how it's going to play out. So Henry then decides to rough it up a bit. And he takes sends various armies north. And basically what they do is they occupy this very southern part of Scotland. And what they do is they take the castles of Berwick and Roxburgh and Jedburgh, and they form almost like a new English province north of the border. It's a buffer zone as well. And what's going to happen is that from there they can then go north and raid lands and basically pummel at Scotland until you give up and hand over the Queen. And then it's basically it's not subtle. and the Scots, of course, are being ground down all the time by this. But now what we'll do is we'll walk and we'll go on to Deer Street and I'll give you an overview of what happens here. Okay. So.
During this time, the border saw numerous battles. Many castles were besieged and destroyed, and the lands changed hands back and forth between the English and the Scots. In February 1545, a small Scottish army defeated an English garrison stationed at nearby Jedburgh, right here on the grounds of Deer Street. They were outnumbered 2-1 and much less trained than the soldiers and mercenaries fighting for Henry VIII. How they did that was somewhat of a mystery for a long time. If only the Bronze Age standing stone in the field ahead could tell the stories of what it has seen. But it remains a silent witness of the past. Until local historians like Jeff came along and showed an interest in the history of their area. Aided by modern archaeological survey techniques and a PhD student researching conflict archaeology, they were finally able to piece together a theory of what might have happened on that fateful day almost 500 years ago. With the help of aerial photography and radar scans, the group was able to identify a squeeze point where the English garrison had no room to manoeuvre. All the Scottish army had to do was to hide behind the ridge and wait for the English troops to arrive. A second group of Scots came from behind, and so the fate of the English was sealed. Without the work of local historians and professional archaeologists coming together, little would be known about this battle today. And people like me might forever look at the landscape, oblivious to the things that took place here. After learning so much from the people who make archaeology happen, it's time to give it a go ourselves. Back at Hume Castle, Ian and Michelle showed us how to record a monument in the landscape. We measured the outlines of the structures we made out on the ground and filled in a form to describe what they looked like, where they were located in relation to the castle, and what they might have been. This time, we're walking towards Roxburgh Castle on the outskirts of Kelso. There was once a densely populated settlement here, wedged between the rivers Tweed and Teviot. It was the place of the first royal mint, pressing coins for Scottish kings and queens. And together with the dramatic abbey in Kelso, it was a stronghold of power. The borough was surrounded by water, and the only access by land was guarded by a majestic castle. Today, the remains of the settlement are long gone, buried under layers of soil used for sheep grazing and by the local angling club. But from the path along the river, we can see what's left of the castle. At the top of a steep slope stands a weathered stone wall. At the far side, there's a hole in it, too large for a window, too erratic for a doorway. Most likely, it was caused by erosion and time. We climb a narrow footpath through dried and bent over grass and enter the structure. There are remains of walls all around us, giving an indication of the area this castle once took up. And it's enormous. We follow Ian over to the far side of the castle and climb a wee hill, only that we know it's not a natural hill. It's rubble from the ruined castle that was claimed back by nature over the centuries. From the top, we get an idea of how difficult it would have been to attack the castle with its steep embankments and tall walls. After a wee break in the sunshine, we head over to another corner of the structure, and here, sheltered from the wind, we begin recording another monument.
Folder there.
Yeah.
Yep. So I don't know how you want to divide yourselves up, and I'll hand out a sheet. There we go. There we go.
Well, you clearly have a hole in here again.
Yeah.
That looks like there might have been a beam or something like that,
which is at a weird height.
The feature we're looking at is a stone wall. It's significantly taller than me and made up of dressed stones. That means stones that were cut and shaped intentionally to make a smooth wall. They're held together with lime mortar, although more recent restoration efforts added cement to the mix as well. My teammate Kelly and I inspect every inch of the wall. We make sketches of individual stones, discuss signs of erosion, and speculate over what this building might have been, what shape it was in its heyday, and what purpose it might have served. We use the lingo we picked up from the archaeologists and historians we'd met on this trip so far, and felt really accomplished when we presented our annotated sketches and interpretations to Ian and the others. This is archaeology in action.
Much more smooth, straight stone wall. And again, you've got this, the lime mortar, and unfortunately quite a bit of concrete as well.
We all work differently, which is very interesting with the team. Each researcher works in a different way.
From Roxburgh, we made our way to Gala Shields for a workshop with the Borders Family History Society. The volunteers there showed us the ropes of tracing our ancestry and how to use snippets of information to work backwards through the records. Lacking my own Scottish ancestry, I asked one of the volunteers to help me look up my partner's ancestors. And to my amusement, we found birth records and marriage certificates for people I had never met and yet felt connected to. Family history research can be a great tool for archaeologists to learn more about the people who inhabited the monuments they observe. And at the same time, you may want to pick up some archaeological skills to learn more about the places your ancestors inhabited. There are so many things I learned on my trip to the Borders with Harp Archaeology. How to read historic buildings, how to draw out the stories of a kirkyard before ever reading the inscriptions on the gravestones. We heard about the Romans in Melrose, the Reavers raiding the lands during the Border Wars, and the conflicts that shaped this landscape during the Middle Ages. I learnt that archaeology is inextricably linked to other subjects, be it history, geography, reading maps, or tracing family lines. But most importantly, I've learned that the landscapes I see on my travels around Scotland are always full of traces left behind by the people who came before me. You just need to open your senses and read the lumps and bumps in the landscape like an open book. I hope you enjoyed this story about my experience with Harp Archaeology in the Scottish Borders. Ian and Michelle have just launched their tour dates for the forthcoming season, so you can now book one of these experiences yourself. They offer 3- and 5-day tours through the borders, including accommodation, meals, and of course, expert guidance on the road and at the historic sites they visit. In addition to the places I told you about in the story, the tours also include stops at places like Kelso and Melrose Abbey, Abbotsford House, the home of Sir Walter Scott, Smailholm Tower, or Scott's View. Ian and Michelle have handpicked the locations you visit on these trips, and spent many years forming relationships with local community groups, many of which rely heavily on volunteer contributions. I loved learning that part of the money they make from the tours will go towards these groups to support their work. I particularly enjoyed the opportunity to meet so many passionate experts in their field, and especially our shared meals were a great opportunity to learn more about their work as archaeologists. Even though I had never aspired to be an archaeologist myself, I now have a much deeper appreciation of their work, and I can't wait to apply some of the skills I learned on future trips to historic sites around Scotland. I will link to Harp Archaeology and their tours in the show notes. After spending 3 days with them on the road, I have no doubt that you'd have an amazing time too, learning about archaeology and Scottish history. Members of our Patreon community, the Wild for Scotland Social Club, will get to hear even more from Ian and Michelle this month. We took some time during our trip to record a longer conversation, in which we talk about all things archaeology, including difficult subjects like how Western archaeology can clash with Indigenous cultures, and how that can play out in digs on Gaelic land. I also share a bit more about my own fascination with archaeology, which, maybe to your surprise, has nothing to do with Indiana Jones. If you've not joined our Patreon community yet, you're really missing out. Head on over to patreon.com/wildforscotland to join the Wild for Scotland Social Club for as little as £3 a month. You can find the link in the show notes. And with this, I send you off to dream about your own archaeology-inspired trip to the Scottish borders. I'm going to be travelling a lot in the next few months, so any new stories I'm working on will have to wait for a wee while. If you're new to the show and enjoyed today's episode, scroll back in our feed and check out some of our other history-related stories, like Pete and Zan's about the Isle of Lewis from Season 2, or 6,000 Times Around the Sun about the historic sites around Kilmartin Glen, which was part of Season 4. Thank you so much for listening to Wild for Scotland. We love telling stories that are truly inspiring. So if any of our episodes have ever inspired you to visit a certain location, book an activity, or change something about the way you look at the world, we'd love to hear from you. Leave a review or post about it on social media and tag us. Thank you so much. Wild for Scotland is part of the Tremula Network, adventure and outdoor podcasts off the beaten path. The show is written and hosted by me, Kathy Kamleitner. Thanks to Fran Turowskis, who's the co-producer and editor and does the sound design. Podcast art is by Lizzie Vaughan Knight, and all original music is composed by Bruce Wallace. Thanks again to Harp Archaeology for commissioning this episode. Until next time, when we travel to a different place in Scotland. If you're still here, listening all the way to the very end, it means you've probably got your hands full. So let me take this opportunity to remind you that I don't just write immersive travel stories. I also plan unforgettable itineraries for Scotland, and it's never been easier to follow one of my routes. Head to watchmesee.com/shop to browse my ready-made Scotland itineraries and turn your travel dreams into reality.